KALW.
My grandparents saved a generation of children, and I tell Steph Curry to shoot the ball from 30 feet out and make a good shot. And
some people may consider Golden State Warriors head coach Steve Kerr a champion, but his grandparents actually saved lives.
They had an awareness of what was going on in the world and the atrocities that were happening in Turkey and Armenia.
We'll hear the story of how Kerr's grandparents helped thousands of orphans during the Armenian genocide. Then from Uncuffed, a man reflects on how playing baseball at San Quentin helped him rebuild his relationship with his father.
And I seen something that just brought this feeling to my heart, and it was just a baseball field.
Plus, a new author reading from new arrivals. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. If you live in the Bay Area and you're a basketball fan, you may recognize this voice.
So I have been blessed in my NBA career to go through a few of these championship celebrations. Seven to be exact.
Steve Kerr is the head coach for the Golden State Warriors. He's an eight-time NBA champion, five times as a player, three times as a coach. Pretty impressive. But for some people, the heroes in Coach Kerr's family are his grandparents. Reporter Sona Avakian has the story.
Please welcome to our KZV community the coach of the Golden State Warriors, Steve Kerr, and his family.
Last year, in the main hall of the KZV Armenian School on Brotherhood Way, Coach Steve Kerr spoke to an adoring crowd. Basketball fans and non-basketball fans cheered. Everyone there knew his grandparents, Stanley and Elsa Kerr, were the stars of the night. People like me, who are descendants of survivors of the Armenian Genocide, knew the names Stanley and Elsa Kerr before we ever knew the name Steve Kerr.
I found out quickly when I walked in here a couple of hours ago that it's good to be the grandson of Stanley and Elsa Kerr. Particularly if you also happen to be the Warriors coach. And you find yourself in San Francisco in a room full of Armenians. So I lucked out. I lucked out tonight.
Just after World War I, Stanley Kerr, the son of a minister from Pennsylvania, and Elsa Reckman, who was from Ohio, arrived separately in the Middle East. Both were in their early 20s and were horrified by news reports on the Armenian Genocide, in which 1.5 million Armenians were systematically killed by the Ottoman government.
Each one shared this spirit of adventure and recognized what was happening. They had an awareness of what was going on in the world and the atrocities were happening in Turkey and Armenia. And so they joined this relief effort, and that's where they met.
They married in Beirut in 1922. The young couple ran the Nahir Ibrahim Orphanage, caring for thousands of children who had lost or become separated from their families during the Armenian Genocide. And Armenians have been in love with the Kerr family ever since.
There's a huge Armenian population in Los Angeles,
which is where Steve Kerr grew up.
And it seemed like we had just a ton of Armenian friends. So they would frequently end up at our house or vice versa, and we'd did barbecues. And I would hear stories from them about my grandparents.
In fact, lots of people heard stories about Steve Kerr's grandparents. One such person was Anahit Kachyan.
My father, Azad Kachyan, was born in 1908 in the city of Trabzon,
a city on the coast of the Black Sea in the country that is today known as Turkey. Then it was the Ottoman Empire, and it was not a safe place for Armenians, a Christian minority. Even in the few decades before World War I, hundreds of thousands of Armenians had been killed in a series of massacres. In 1915, when Anahit's father was a young boy, the Armenian Genocide began. That year, Azad's family tried to escape.
My grandmother kept telling her husband, "We must get out, we must get out. It's looking very, very bad." And he resisted, And then one day, they decided they must go to the coast to leave, only to be told that they could not allow any more Armenians to depart, that the last Armenians left in the morning, and here they were arriving in the afternoon, and they were forbidden from boarding the ship and departing. And from then on, it was chaos.
In that chaos, Azad and his younger sister got separated from their parents and then from each other.
In time, he learned that his father had been shot right in the city and his mother was put on the march.
One of the deportation marches Armenians were put on. They usually ended in camps in the desert of Deir Zor in present-day Syria, where they were left to die. So many perished that as recently as 2002, you could easily find human remains. Azad himself was eventually forced on the march.
That went on till we think 1916, 17. He was still on the march. And in time, in the southeastern Turkey, World War I had ended, and the Americans were coming to help. And in fact, the Red Cross appeared, and my father quickly learned English. And we believe it's the Red Cross that brought the children to Beirut,
where Stanley and Elsa Kerr ran the Nahir Ibrahim Orphanage for Boys outside the city limits.
They were very good to him.
And because Azad spoke English,
the Kerrs would take him into Beirut offices when they had to do some formalities. And they would take him as a translator in case the Arab official was not able to converse logically.
In 1923, a malaria outbreak forced the orphanage to close. Some of the boys, including Azad, moved with the Kerrs closer to the city of Beirut, where he was able to attend high school classes. And when it came time for Azad to further his education,
Dr. Kerr came to him and he said, "What would you like to be studying? You can go to college, American University of Beirut." Dr. Kerr was a chemist, a PhD in chemistry. And my father told him, "I want to be a doctor." And so Dr. Kerr saw to it that he would be on track.
Not long after that, Azad found out both his mother and sister had survived the genocide. Eventually, the three of them were reunited. And thanks to the Kerrs, Azad did become a doctor. He married in 1942, and he and his wife had Anahid and two other daughters and moved to central Syria. And when Anahid was young, the Kerrs came to visit.
In the desert, they came to visit us. And we had no idea. I was maybe 5-6 years old at the time. But my parents were in awe of, my goodness, they'd come all the way here. And my mom cooked and prepared. And so it was very, very special.
The Kerrs, especially Elsa, made an impression on Anahid.
And I remember Mrs. Kerr, how tall she was. And she loved math. She had been a math teacher. And I loved math.
In the late 70s, as a young adult, Anahid was able to meet the Kerrs again. By then, she and her family had immigrated to the States, where her father was a successful doctor in the Midwest. Stanley and Elsa Kerr had retired and settled in Princeton, New Jersey.
And when my father heard Princeton, he said, "Oh, no matter what else you do, you've got to go see the Kerrs." Gave me their phone number, their address, and I did get to go. And I just thanked them and thanked them and thanked them and thanked them.
Last year, Anahid and her husband drove to San Francisco from their home in Colorado to attend that banquet honoring the Kerr family.
I was weeping because here was my family's. I'm in tears and I want to smile and I have tears, but there was no question of how profoundly I was affected by, on behalf of the Armenians all around in that room, but I know it's also because of my family that I'm representing. And it was extremely moving for me, extremely. It sends chills today when I think about the reality of it. And Steve put his, just come grab me and just help me just stabilize a little bit. He's a good guy.
I'm proud because everybody in my family, I feel like just wants to help others. And we all do it in our own separate ways. My grandparents saved a generation of children, and I tell Steph Curry to shoot the ball from 30 feet out and make a good shot. And
it's no surprise that Stanley and Elsa Kerr's values, being there for those less fortunate, pass from them to their children and grandchildren.
George Floyd! George Floyd!
The day after George Floyd was killed, Steve Kerr tweeted, "This is murder. Disgusting. Seriously, what the hell is wrong with us?" And in June, when Black Lives Matter marches were in full swing around the world, Steve Kerr went back to Oakland, the former home of the Warriors.
I'm here really for one reason. That's because these last couple of weeks especially, but over the past few years, I think there's been a real reckoning for much of America, especially for white America, that we have to reimagine the way black communities are living. And we have to reimagine our support of black communities. Thank you.
100%. It's incumbent on white people to support the movement, because supporting the movement is supporting freedom and anti-racism, which is really, I think, a key to trying to create justice in this country. Where it hasn't existed. And we've had this opportunity to chase our dreams and to live this amazing life and this feel this freedom. And there's part of the phrase white privilege is just being oblivious to the fact that that American dream is not available to everybody.
And that's not a surprising thing for the grandson of Stanley and Elsa Kerr to say. For Cross Currents, I'm Sona Avakian.
Thanks, Sona. Sona was a fellow in our 2019 Audio Academy training program. And a note, in 2016, Stanley and Elsa Kerr were posthumously awarded the Raoul Wallenberg Medal of Freedom for their work helping Armenian children. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up is a story from the producers of Uncuffed at San Quentin Radio. Cleo Kloman has spent over two decades behind bars for murder. He grew up in a two-parent household, and he had dreams of playing professional baseball. After a rocky relationship with his father, he lost his passion for baseball and found his new passion on the streets, which ultimately cost him his freedom. Throughout his years of incarceration, he was able to rebuild his relationship with his father and eventually regain his passion for baseball inside the walls of San Quentin. From San Quentin Radio, Greg Eskridge has his story.
So my family life was a blessing and a curse. I had both of my parents as a blessing. My mother and my father, they was there. The curse was that there was addiction in my household, particularly by my father. He was an alcoholic, he was a drug user, and he was a womanizer. And that played a big toll in my household. One thing that I realized my dad loved was sports. So that was my like my number one priority. It's like I had to excel in sports in order to get my dad to smile. When we were outside our home, we was in the community playing sports, I seen my dad light up like the brightest star in the world. And when I watched him watch me play, I could see how proud he was. And I did everything possible to keep that proudness that he wore on his face. My dad tried his best, but he changed. He became a different person. In the home, he was a monster. Outside the home, he was my magical creature, my best friend, the person that I enjoyed being around. And it was just feeling like I was living two different lifestyles. I didn't know how to deal with what I was going through. I didn't even understand what I was going through. I knew I felt something. I felt a sense of fear. I felt a sense of nervousness. But I couldn't understand where it was coming from. I didn't understand what to do with it. I thought, you know, things that I did was gonna change the feeling, was gonna allow me to build that relationship with my father. But nothing I did inside the home worked. I started going outside my home to find things to feel good. And one thing that I started doing was smoking weed, drinking, having sex more often. And these things were allowing me to feel better about myself. But I realize now it was an escape. It was a place where I didn't have to deal with what I was dealing with at home, which was the fear and the nervousness of what my dad is gonna do next. I eventually went to the streets and got away from baseball and lost my focus on my hopes and dreams. What the streets did was it painted a picture like it was all fine and dandy and it was gonna be much greater than baseball, but all along, the darkness overcame me. So I started committing crimes for money, I started robbing for money, and thinking money was gonna solve all my problems. But what I lacked was the education of money. So the things that I was robbing for, I was just spending it on frivolous stuff, clothes, jewelry, drugs, parties. And when that money was spent, I went right back to what I knew, how to go rob and take from others. On January 16, 1996, it was just like any other ordinary day for me. I was gonna go commit a robbery for money so I could support my habit and my greed. That was one of the choices that has changed my life forever. I made a choice to go commit a robbery, and in the process of robbing a grocery store manager, he stood up for his right to live, and he was murdered for that. I am responsible for Mr. Soho being murdered, and I received 25 years to life in prison with the possibility of parole. So 2011, right after Thanksgiving holidays, I was transferred to San Quentin. And as driving up on a bus to R&R, I was looking out the window and I seen something that just made me smile and brought this feeling to my heart, my mind, my soul. I could feel it all the way to my feet. And it was just a baseball field. And I remember walking down the stairs, walking past the tables, and just coming down smelling the grass. But when I took that first step on the grass in left field, everything went silent. All I could remember was the texture of the grass underneath my feet. It seemed like I could smell the dirt. I could smell the crowd, the snack stands. It was like a transcending feeling. And somebody hit the ball to me, and I remember the sound of the crack. It just said, crack. And I'm watching the ball fly in the air, and it's coming closer, closer. I got underneath it, perfect form, perfect technique. And I heard that ball hit the glove, and then at that moment, it was no stopping me. All I kept thinking about was that little kid running around the bases, hitting the balls in the gap, clapping hands with my teammates. And I thought about my dad, you know, how he would feel if he could just come here and watch me play again. My dad is my best friend. And I realized something. If I hate my dad, I hate myself. If I love myself, I love my dad because I am my dad. I have the same qualities as my dad. My dad is compassionate. My dad is humble. My dad is outgoing. My dad is loving. My dad is a people's person. And those are the same qualities and characteristics that I display. And I learned that from him.
Cleo Kloman was released on May 19th, 2017. He returned to his home in Southern California. That story was produced by Greg Eskridge, a producer in KALW's San Quentin radio program, and there's an extended version on the Uncuffed podcast. Find it at weareuncuffed.org. Uncuffed is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, it's New Arrivals, our mini reading series with local authors. Here's host Lisa Morehouse.
This is New Arrivals, a socially distanced book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Bridget Quinn lives in San Francisco. Her new illustrated book is called She Votes: How U.S. Women Won Suffrage and What Happened Next. It came out in August.
And it's about the many ways that so many different kinds of women in the United States have fought to make their voices heard and continue to do so. And it's illustrated by 100 fabulous artists. And I'm going to read just a little piece from a chapter about the poet Audre Lorde, because I think she really embodies the brilliance of art and activism that I hope the book expresses. In 1977, Audre Lorde was chosen to speak at the Modern Language Association conference in Chicago. Spotlighted at center stage, she announced she'd recently undergone surgery for a breast tumor, a biopsy that required a three-week wait to find out if she'd live or die. The procedure had gotten her thinking about her life and shuffling through her regrets, she told the audience. "What I most regretted," Lorde said, "were my silences." Then she talked about the community of women who supported her, about finding her voice and strength. She went on, "Perhaps for some of you here today, I am the face of one of your fears. Because I am a woman, because I am Black, because I am lesbian, because I am myself, a Black woman warrior poet doing my work, come to ask you, are you doing yours?"
That was Bridget Quinn reading from She Votes. New Arrivals is produced by KALW Public Radio.
New Arrivals is produced by KALW's Lisa Morehouse. Find out how to subscribe to the podcast at KALW.org/New Arrivals. Tune in tomorrow at 5. Some people think menstrual products should be free, especially for people living on the streets.
I would just use toilet paper. It is hard, especially with nowhere to go to wash, to shower.
Getting your period when you're homeless. Tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. And before we leave you, here's some new music from a local artist. This is Dougie Stew from Oakland. His new record is called Familiar Future. Thank you.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Scott Carroll, Sonia Narung, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Lisa Ramreka. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.